Her body was discovered in a nearby wooded area.
She was stabbed 19 times and left for dead,
where two adults have been shot to death.
143 people have been murdered. Hundreds more have been shot.
She had been stabbed to death.
It was the bloodiest thing I think I've ever been to.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Dark and Deadly. We are your hosts. I'm Haley.
And I'm Gina.
And today we are going to be covering two cases under the topic that you guys chose, which was double lives. And if you're listening to this for the first time, once a month we run a survey with four topics our listeners get to choose from. And then we get to find, or and then we both find two different cases that pertain to that topic and do a two case episode. So if you'd like to the chance to vote for next month and also see all the other stuff we post on our Instagram, like funny memes, and we do our, Gina posts about the cases that we cover that week. So you should head over to our Instagram at Dark and Deadly Pod. These are like some of my favorite episodes to do. So it's always fun when everybody can be involved in the kind of cases we choose.
Oh, fully. And it's also nice when we don't have to like just come up with a random case, but we're given a topic, because then you're diving into all of these different cases. And then there's times where I'm like, ooh, that's a really cool case. I'll do that one later. And ooh, what's this one? Okay, I can do this for a future case. So it just gives us like even more ideas, because our last one was amazing and hard to find cases on that.
The killer kids?
No, not our last one, then our first one.
Which was what?
Oh, I can't remember it. It wasn't killer kids. It was the one with a mermaid on the emoji.
Oh, like the strange, like the uncommon ways to die or whatever. What was it called? Hold on.
Paranormal deaths?
We're terrible.
Oh, we are. Sorry, guys.
Unusual manner of murder.
Yes, that was hard. I was surprised at how hard that was to find cases, because before we were throwing out these ideas, neither Haley or I is like looking into being like, ooh, could we get good cases with these? We're just coming up with like fun, weird topics and saying, ooh, let's do these, this, and this.
Right. And those, I mean, these episodes are some of our like most popular, it seems like, too. So it's always fun to have everybody give their opinion on what you guys want to hear.
Yeah.
So do you want to start us off? I'm really excited for your case.
Yes, I do want to start us off.
Okay.
Okay. The case I'm covering for our Double Lives episode is about Charlie Brandt and the scary double life he led. Charlie Brandt and his wife, Terry, were staying with Terry's niece, Michelle, while riding out Hurricane Ivan. They lived in the Florida Keys, and that's right about where the hurricane was coming for. So they boarded up their house. Charlie was not happy about having to be evacuated either. He did not want to leave his house, which is, I mean, somewhat understandable. I get it. You never know what you're going to come home to, I think, in those situations. And I think it can be just a really anxious time.
I don't know how people choose to live in Hurricane Alley and like where tornadoes are.
Tornadoes is the big one for me.
They scare the crap out of me.
Mm-hmm. Terrify me. We could get them. I mean, in Idaho, we've had tornadoes before, but it's so rare, and it's rare for us to get like earthquakes like the one we had last year. I've never felt an earthquake before. And we have them, but nothing that's so severe, especially that you usually feel it down in Boise. But the one we had last year, it felt like our house was rolling. It was the weirdest sensation. So I've always been curious about like people living in California near the earthquakes. You live in Tornado Alley, or you're living in like Hurricane Alley.
Yeah, there was actually a earthquake here a few months ago, and I was actually at I'm still dying. Hold on.
A hurricane or a tornado?
Sorry. Okay. No, earthquake.
Oh.
So a few months ago, there was an earthquake and I was actually getting my nails done. Shout out to Jen. Hey, what's up? And she was sitting there doing my nails and all of a sudden all of her nail polishes and like the whole wall started shaking and we were like, what the heck? And so we like ran out into the lobby and there was like people doing construction on the side. So they thought, we thought they had just had like some equipment that shook the building. No, it was an earthquake. It was scary.
It's the weirdest sensation, isn't it?
Yeah, we had no idea. And then like 5 minutes later, we got alerts on our phone.
The one we had here, everyone like pretty instantly knew, I think, but it was up in the Stanley area, and Stanley from Boise, it's a 2 hour drive ish, 2.5 hour drive. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's up there and they get tornadoes. Oh my gosh. They get earthquakes pretty often, but anyways, weird stuff.
Mother Nature, man.
Yes, she's a fickle. I want to say woman, but that sounds weird.
I know.
So while he was up where Michelle was, he had visited his dad and his sister while up there, and he made it known that he did not want to be there. He was like, I'm ready to go home any day now. I'm just waiting for Terry to say that we're good to leave. Which, I mean, I get it. You're anxious. You're away from your house. No one wants to be away from their home. And Charlie has been described as a pretty mild-mannered man, just easygoing, maybe on the bit of like the eccentric side, but like quiet, just normal. Charlie and Terry, their personalities were super well suited together. Terry was described as gypsy-like, so happy-go-lucky, free spirit, just go with the flow. One of those people, when you're around them, you feel good, you know? Nothing bothered her. She was a wonderful person, very kind, very sweet. Terry's closest friend, Michelle Fetcher, said Terry and Charlie were like inseparable. She said, if my husband could love me one third the amount that Charlie loved Terry, I'd be the luckiest woman in the world.
Aww.
Right?
How sweet. So
super in love couple. They probably, I mean, from how they're described, it sounds like my parents.
Yeah.
Just totally in love with each other. They would often do things for the other. One of the things that they would do is they would make lunches for each other. They said because the lunch tastes better when it was made by the one who loved you.
Oh, I used to take bites out of Tom's lunch. I should do that again.
Yeah. See, that's just a wife. That's the
just
wife
to prove tax. That it wasn't poisoned.
Oh,
fine.
Terry's niece Michelle also loved hanging out with her aunt and uncle. So she adored them, loved being around them, enjoyed their company. Even Michelle's friends loved them. One of her friends, Lisa, had come over on September 12th and had hung out with them. They had all been drinking, so Lisa ended up staying the night. She slept in Michelle's room with her since Terry and Charlie had taken the guest bedroom. So she slept with Michelle in her bed. And the issue, though, is that she slept in Michelle's room with her, but she had an allergy to cats, which Michelle had. So she was up and down all night having some allergy issues. She kept, right? It's when you have an allergy to cats, I'm pretty much always imagining like your eyes are itchy. You're maybe having like, feel like there's something in your throat. Sorry. I just hit the mic. Your eyes are itchy. You're maybe having like the feeling of something in your throat. I don't have an allergy to cats.
Itchy eyes. My neck will start to itch. My throat starts to close up. That's because I'm like really allergic and have asthma, but like it's miserable.
Good thing my parents have cats, Haley.
I know. It's always a really fun time. I just load up on the Allegra and have my inhaler in my pocket at all times.
Oh, Haley.
You guys are worth it. It's fine.
Oh, and I will say one of our cats is your fault. So
it is true. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Charlie needed a home and I couldn't provide it. So I picked the next best family.
you blackmailed me into taking it. Not blackmail.
I wouldn't call it blackmail.
You told me that you would take him and you couldn't play with him, so he just sit in the room.
It was more of a manipulation tactic.
Yes. Emotional manipulation for the girl who can't say no.
Mm-hmm.
Me.
Precisely.
Yep.
It worked out.
It did. No, Chuck is like the best cat ever. So Lisa continued to get up and go out to the kitchen to get a glass of water. And she kept seeing Charlie in the kitchen each time that she would get up to go. And she said she got up about 3 times. And she thought this was odd that each time she was getting up that he was in the kitchen. So either he was up the whole time just in the kitchen or just happened to be there. Like it's weird timing, right?
I agree. Like,
yeah.
He's not just like getting up because she's getting up, right?
Who knows? So when she mentioned it to Michelle, Michelle brushed it off and said he was a big teddy bear. There's nothing to worry about. Just like a weird coincidence. But like that creepy feeling stayed with Lisa. It didn't really dissipate. Lisa was going to come over the following night, but got a call from Michelle saying that she shouldn't come over because Terry and Charlie had been drinking and had a bit of a fight and she was tired and she was just going to go to bed. So Lisa said, okay, no worries. That's fine. Totally get it. When you drink, sometimes people get in fights.
Yeah. So quick question. Sorry. What year is this?
2004.
Really?
Yes.
Fascinating. Okay.
So
you're telling evacuated. Me a year before I went to Florida, there was a serial killer on the loose.
Yes. So September 2nd, 2004 is when they evacuated their home and we're now on September 12th.
Holy moly. Okay.
So they stayed with her for 10 days, which is probably why Charlie was like, I'm ready to go home.
Yeah. No kidding.
And Terry just wasn't in a rush. She enjoyed staying with her niece. She just wasn't in a rush. Michelle's mom, Mary Lou, and her were very close. They talked daily at a minimum, if not multiple times a day. Her mom called her on the 13th and didn't hear back. But she didn't think too much of it. I mean, sometimes they just missed each other. Oh, maybe she got her message and then just forgot to call back. It happens. But she didn't hear back the next day or the next day. So for 3 days, she didn't hear anything. And finally, she had enough. Mary Lou called one of Michelle's friends, Debbie, who had a spare key for Michelle's place. All of her and her friends had keys for each other's homes. So super close girl group. They shared keys in case, you know, anything like this happened. Debbie heads over to check what's going on. She tried to use her key in the front door, but couldn't get the key to turn. And I halfway wonder if, because the whole group had each other's keys, if maybe she just used the wrong key.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, that could happen and you lose track of whose keys whose. So she went around back to see if she could see in the window. She was knocking, didn't hear anything inside. When she got to the back, Michelle's garage door was made of almost entirely glass. And that's when Debbie made the gruesome discovery of Charlie's body hanging from a rafter in the garage by a bed sheet.
How awful to find that.
Mm-hmm. And keep in mind,
and
it's been at least, I mean, we're talking 3 days. Even Rob Hemmert, the lead investigator had to compose himself for what he was about to walk into. He said he could see Charlie hanging from the rafters in the garage. He was hanging by a bed sheet, which was around his neck, and there was a ladder close to his body. So it was pretty obvious he had committed suicide.
Yeah.
Like the ladder, he's hanging by a bed sheet, typical things that I think you would see in that type of suicide at a home. He couldn't imagine what else had awaited for him inside Michelle's meticulous house. He said of the house, it was a nice home, It had the feminine kind of feel to it. All of these nice decorations and the aroma of her home was masked by death, the smell of death. Terry's body sat slumped on the living room couch. She had been stabbed 7 times in the chest. Michelle's mutilated body was in her room. Michelle was decapitated with her head next to her body, watching herself almost. Her organs, including her heart, were arranged around her. Her breasts had been cut off, and all of her Victoria's Secret underwear was spread all around her room, just like all over. I've seen some articles that mentioned that she had been sexually assaulted as well.
Oh.
What killed her, like the ultimate thing that killed her, was one knife wound to the chest. So that was what had initially killed her. And then all of this, from what I read, had been done after she had died. Oh, and then the other thing, her bloody clothes were in the sink and her intestines and bowels were in the trash.
Oh my gosh.
So all three bodies had been locked in the house for the 13th. We're assuming that this happened the night of the 12th, the 13th, the 14th, and then the 15th when they were down. So 3 days. He was in a garage that wasn't, you know, air conditioned. So he's in sweltering heat. They're in a house. Yeah. So they're in a house that has air conditioning, but still it's not a pretty sight. And the detectives came to like the only conclusion that they could really come to, because everything was locked, that Charlie had committed the murders and then hung himself.
Yeah. That would be my
thought. Because what else? Like, no. Unless this is like the most elaborate frame job ever of a person. It's pretty obvious that he did it. As the detectives kind of pieced all of this together, the evening seemed to have started pretty innocently enough. So they knew that they had dinner together. They could tell that Charlie had been cooking fish. It looks like they may have had some drinks, which checks out because Michelle had called her friend Lisa and said, hey, don't come over. We've been drinking and they're fighting.
Yeah.
And he had learned that they had planned. So Charlie and Terry had planned to leave that night. Their bags were sitting by the door, ready to go. But for some reason, Charlie insisted on staying that extra night. So, as of right now, do you think it was premeditated?
I mean, in a way, like, I think that he probably was intoxicated and then kind of like came to that conclusion, and because they were going to leave.
So, the interesting thing is, Charlie, when he had gone to see his dad and his sister, had hugged his dad and said goodbye in like a weird manner, something that felt pretty final to them.
Okay.
So to me, at a minimum, I think that he planned on killing somebody that night. So Charlie had used Michelle's own kitchen knives to kill both of them. Terry was killed in like a quick, repeated style stabbing attack to her chest, while Michelle was like one fatal wound to the chest. The detective said that he then carefully put her blood-soaked clothes in the bathroom sink. So like all of this took time and thought. This wasn't like a heat of the moment passion type killing,
right? Very organized, but like a chaotic organized.
Yes, exactly. So remember that everyone described Terry and Charlie as being just madly in love with each other, and yet like Charlie stabbed his wife 7 times. He left no note or an explanation, nothing. But the first hints came a few days later from an unexpected source, Charlie's older sister, Angela. Angela shared with investigators an explosive secret, a secret her distraught family had kept hidden for more than 3 decades. She told in a taped interview to the detectives exactly what happened that night in January 1971. At the time, Angela was 15 and Charlie was 13, and they lived in Indiana. So normal lives at this point. They're both teenagers. Nothing weird has happened.
Okay.
I haven't told this story. I can't remember when.
This is Investigator Rob Hemmert with the Seminole County Sheriff's Office. The person being interviewed is Angela, and the last name is Brandt. That's all right.
Okay, I won't cry.
All right.
It was January 3rd, 1971.
Charlie was 13?
Yes.
And Angela, you were how old? 15. Tell me again what took place and what was going on.
9:10 p.m.
Okay.
We had just gotten a color TV.
Right.
So we were all sitting around watching the FBI, you know, Effins and Bliss Jr. and all that.
Okay.
The FBI was over. We went upstairs. I went and got in bed to read my book like I always did before I went to sleep.
Okay.
My mom ran a bath and read Time magazine. My dad was shaving.
Okay. So you're in your bed reading, and what happens next?
I heard loud noises, which I perceived to be firecrackers.
Okay.
For the simple reason, not that that makes any sense.
That's all right.
But, I mean, you know, I just, what other loud noises there?
Popping.
Yeah, just a really loud noise. And I just, like I said, I just thought it was firecrackers. So I started pulling the covers back to see why on earth, you know, there was all this noise going on. But then I heard my father yell, Charlie, don't, or Charlie, stop. And my mom was just screaming, and the last thing I ever heard my mom say was, Angela, call the police.
So what happens after that?
So I was removing the covers from my bed and getting out of the bed, and all this took place in split seconds.
Okay.
I mean, this has got to be less than a minute, I would think, okay? Right. And I get up, and as I'm getting up, he comes into my room.
Charlie.
Okay. Brandishing the gun, a gun. I didn't even realize what it really was. I mean, until he aimed it at me, and he pulled the trigger.
Okay, so you hear it click.
I could hear it click.
Okay.
And I guess when he realized the gun didn't have any more bullets, that must be what, he threw it on the floor. And as I said, I was lucid enough to kick it under the bed. I didn't know if it had any bullets in it or not. I don't even know what was going on.
Right.
And then a physical altercation ensued. I imagine, I think he struck me. I do. I think he, because I had blood and just bruises, and I fought back. This is the only physical altercation I've ever been in my entire life.
Okay.
And I guess I won because I'm here to tell about it. I don't know.
Right.
And my brain, I remember I was only 15. My brain was trying to assimilate what was going on, and I was trying to get away from him at the same time. He was very strong. Next thing I know that I can remember is I was laying flat on my back. My bed was right here.
On the bed?
On the floor.
Okay.
Probably knocked me to the floor. I don't know.
Okay.
And he was sitting on me, and he was strangling me.
Okay.
I was drifting in and out. I don't think that I got him off of me physically.
All right.
The way I remember it is I saw the weird look on his face, the madness, the glazed over look.
Okay.
I saw it disappear. He just looked more like himself, and he said, what am I doing? Or what have I done? And I remember perfectly saying, I don't know, but I think you shot Dad. Because I heard my dad yelling, Charlie, don't do that, or Charlie, stop. And he said, oh, I did, or whatever. I said, I don't know, but get off of me so we can figure it out, okay? And he did. He got off of me. My next step, I was trying to get out of the house. He goes, sir, you're not going to leave me, are you? Of course. I said no.
Sorry.
No, I would run out the door. And I did. As soon as I thought he was far enough away, I ran. Have you ever seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Yeah.
I saw it once in my life. I could never watch it again. You know the girl screaming?
Yeah.
The way she ran screaming? That was me. I was just a little girl. I was running through the snow in my bloody nightgown, torn, just screaming. I got to the first house right across the street. I didn't knock on the door. I turned the knob, and it was locked. And then I ran to the next house, and by the time I got to the next house, my brother had apparently come down the steps. He was outside. And all my life, I've heard him screaming after me, Angie, you promised you wouldn't leave me. You promised you wouldn't leave me. But I did.
Wow.
You can tell, though, that in her voice when she like breaks
she got
down,
choked up.
Oh man,
right? That's pain.
Oh yeah.
And so she said that she is terrified of him. Like she lived the rest of her life terrified of him.
How could you not be?
Oh, fully, right?
I mean, it kind of reminds me of Halloween, like I would feel like he's constantly gonna try and come after me because I would got away.
Yep, exactly. So his mom was 8 months pregnant.
Oh.
When he shot her in the bath, he came up and shot her. She died. His father lived.
Oh, okay.
So the dad lived. And that's important to note because obviously we talked about how he saw him and said that weird goodbye.
Yeah.
So newspaper reports of the murder are kind of what you would expect from then almost. It was portrayed as a freakish crime by a quiet kid, the last kid on the earth. People who knew the family said would do this. Like, there's no way. He was known as a mama's boy. People just could not fathom how the two were connected. So it was a bit of like a splash all over the newspaper because it's such a shocking crime. And it kind of let him off in a way almost, if that makes sense. Yeah. It's important to note though, he wasn't charged for this.
At all?
No, he had no record because back then kids couldn't be charged.
Yeah.
So he was never charged for any of this. He was sent to a psychiatric hospital where he stayed for just a little bit over a year, only until his dad, who like completely forgave him for this, could win his release through the courts.
Jeez.
So the kid got a year in a psychiatric hospital and that's it for killing his mom and shooting his dad and attacking his sister.
I didn't think that he wasn't gonna like, you can't be rehabilitated for that kind of crime in a year at a psychiatric hospital.
No, not at all.
That is lifelong treatment.
Yep. When Charlie was released, the dad picked up the family and moved them to Florida. Everyone, all of them moved to Florida. While he was there, Charlie's dad got remarried and then moved the family back to Indiana, but left Charlie with his grandparents in Florida.
Oh.
Which okay. Tells me that there had to have been some fear.
Huh? But you're like, it's like, I don't want to die, but you can kill my parents. What?
Right? Kind of like a crappy move to stick the kid who killed your wife on your parents.
Sad.
Right. Like, but this was also like the '70s. Yeah. Not that like just because it's the '70s, it's an excuse, but it was the '70s. And I feel like that happened more often back then, like with pregnant girls where they shipped them off.
Yeah.
And kind of made it like a someone else's problem type of situation.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, obviously his dad forgave him. He got him out of a psychiatric hospital when he should have remained in there for a couple, at least years.
He regretted it, and that's why he left.
Let's get into how Terry and Charlie met. They were introduced by Angela's now ex-husband Jim. So Angela and Jim had divorced by this point, and Jim and Charlie became really good friends. They would go fishing together, like hung out together, and Jim was dating someone who was friends with Terry. Charlie had asked Jim, hey, is there anyone that you could possibly set me up with? And Jim said, hey, I actually know someone, Terry. She's great. Let me get you guys together. And Jim knew about what had happened because he was married to Angela. So he was fully aware that Charlie had killed his mom.
Okay.
What is your opinion on this? Huh?
Did he hate Terry?
Well, okay. So this is what I think a majority of people would think is like, okay, so you knew he had this past, but they became friends. And the Charlie he knew is the same Charlie that everyone else really described, which is just this mild-mannered guy, wouldn't hurt a fly, like easygoing, quiet. He was a radar technician, so kind of nerdy. So like, if that's the man you knew, but you knew when he was, a teenager, a young teenager, killed his mom, how do you rectify the two if you've known this guy to never do anything? Would that change your opinion of what he did?
I don't know.
And they were honestly like best buds.
Well, I mean, if it was your best friend, I'm sure that at that point you would give him the benefit of the doubt and feel like he's a changed man. So
I think that's how Jim felt about all of it, you know? So he didn't say anything to Terry about what Charlie had done. And when they got engaged, Jim had a conversation with Charlie about him needing to tell Terry like what had happened when he was a kid, which is good on him. Probably would have like done that a bit sooner when you knew that they were getting serious and it wasn't like a we'll see if they like each other type of scenario. Or just had like told her out the get-go, like, yep, he killed his mom, just wanted to let you know, do with that what you may.
He seems cool now, so I think you're good.
Yeah, but hey, just FYI.
So Jim feels guilty.
So there's a Dr. Phil interview that Jim was on. And if I'm remembering correctly, he does feel guilty. And it's like hindsight's 20/20. You would have done it differently now that you know he's like what had happened.
Yeah.
So that kind of sucked, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Poor guy.
Yeah.
He just wanted two people to fall in love.
So there's debate among people that are close to the situation about if Terry actually knew what his like what had happened. Her sister Mary Lou claims that there is no way that she could have known about the murder because Terry couldn't keep a secret. She couldn't. You told her something, you had to like beg her to not say anything to anyone else because she was just kind of that happy-go-lucky, I think, would just share because sharing and not think about the consequences of sharing or that it was a secret, you know, just kind of one of those people. Everyone has them in their lives. There's nothing. Yeah. You just know not to tell them anything. And that there's like no way that Terry would be with somebody having known what he was capable of. So like her sister was convinced there's no way she would have told her sisters about like what he had done if she knew. And she just doesn't think that she would have stayed with him because like he shot his mom in cold blood and his father. So she just was convinced there's no way that Terry knew. Jim, though, fully believes that she did because of a certain conversations he had with Terry about another incident that involved Charlie. So Charlie was out and Terry was at home in the kitchen. She heard some noises and went to go investigate. That's when she saw Charlie covered in blood. And when she asked why he was covered in blood, he kind of shook it off and said he had been gutting fish. But she noticed that he didn't have any fish with him. And she
fish aren't that bloody, let's be real.
Right? No, they're not. And she had told Jim, but also they live in the Key West. And I think that they, when they would go fishing, would get like
big fish.
Big fish in the ocean.
Okay.
Like, I think I read somewhere that they caught dolphins.
What?
Don't know if that's legal. Don't know if they turned them back. But that's the type of, like, fishing.
Yeah, like, did. Okay.
Big. But she had noticed like he didn't have the fish with him. So that was kind of a red flag for her, obviously. And she had told Jim about this and then had mentioned, like, I thought it was weird. especially considering everything that had happened. So Jim took that as,
you know, she knows.
She knows.
Yeah.
I think most people would probably take that as, oh, she knows that he killed his mom. Cool.
Well, and you know, like, I don't know, that kind of makes sense to me that Jim, like, that she knew, because I don't know if I was willingly staying with somebody that murdered his mother, like tried to take out his entire family, I'm not sure that's something that I would tell other people.
So about, like, that person, if you're gonna willingly stay with them,
right? I'm not so sure I would, like, go to my sister and be like, oh, by the way, he murdered his mother. I would, like, keep that pretty close in my heart. You know what I'm saying? Like, it would, not that it would be embarrassing, but it's like,
it's embarrassing.
It is embarrassing. It's embarrassing. And you would, like, as a sister, you'd be like, okay, that's a giant red flag. You should probably leave. So right. She probably knew.
Well, and especially if the person, you know, or you think, you know, is described as mild manner and a big teddy bear, of course you're going to think, like, that's not him. He just had a psychotic break.
Exactly. Just like Jim thought he was a changed man and a great guy, like, she probably thought the same. Right. I mean, we do stupid shit as teenagers. We don't murder our families, but, like, we do stuff. We change.
Everyone as we has older. Well, and your hormones and your anger is through the roof for some people. Not that that's an excuse at all. We're not excusing killing parents.
No, yeah. So, I mean, they probably just thought he had grown out of it, I guess. It's not really a good way to explain that, but, you know.
Right. Changed.
Yeah.
And this isn't, like, the only weird thing. So when investigators went through Charlie's house, they saw some stuff. First thing they saw was that when they went into the master bedroom, they spotted a graphic poster of the female anatomy on the back of the bedroom door. What two people, neither of which are in the medical profession, would have that type of thing on the back of a bedroom door, which is something that you would normally find in, like, a medical office?
Yeah.
So the detective said that her hair is put up in a bun, and it's showing the skeletal system and the muscular system.
Okay.
So, like, that's it's odd.
It is weird.
Terry would have seen that poster every day. The detectives wondered why she hadn't considered it a big deal, because, like we said, neither of them were in the medical profession. So I don't know, for me as a woman, I'd be like, why? Why do you have that up?
Yeah. Oh, what?
The detectives had an unsettling answer that they had kind of come to. He said, I'm looking at a chart that's got these portions of the body exposed, and he's virtually duplicated or exposed some of these areas of the body and what he did with Michelle. Mm-hmm. So he probably looked at these daily and thought about mutilating a woman.
Yeah, how to execute that
plan. How to best do it. And keep in mind, this was like a meticulously done murder.
He got it.
How he had done it, they were convinced. They said, this isn't it. This isn't his only time having done this. It was too finely done.
Yeah.
And there were, like, some other things too. So he had medical books, medical journals, an anatomy book. One of the books had a clipping from a newspaper of the anatomy of a human heart, which, keep in mind, he had cut out of her body.
Yeah.
He also had Victoria's Secret catalogs found in the house addressed to him, not his wife. And one really gross thing is that he always referred to Michelle as Victoria's Secret. He never called her Michelle.
Ew.
And spread all over her room was all of her Victoria's Secret underwear and bras.
What a creeper.
Mm-hmm. He was obsessed with her. Like, ew. Objectified her, had weird sexual fantasies about her. When the detectives examined Brandt's computer, they found he had been on horribly graphic websites that featured death fantasies, necrophilia, and violence against women. Like, detectives were quite sure, and if they thought that if they just look hard enough, they would definitely find evidence that Charlie was a serial killer. Like, they were like, this isn't his first time doing this, where we know that there have to be other victims out there.
Yeah.
The only real question was, like, how many victims had there been over some 30 years that he'd remained essentially anonymous to law enforcement because he was never charged? So to answer that, police first tried to match their unsolved murders with Brandt's travels in the United States and abroad. So they started to look at, like, okay, so where do we have murders occurring? Where has he been? They tried to start mapping it out. In search for the unsolved murders, there was one case that they noticed. It was a 1995 murder of Darlene Toler, a prostitute in Miami's Little Havana section. The detective that was handling the case, Detective Pat Diaz, handled the investigation and remembers that it was an odd case. Toler had been decapitated and had her heart removed.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm.
So Toler's body was found along a highway. Apart from the manner of her death, two pieces of evidence convinced Diaz that he was the killer. The body was wrapped up in a blanket, then wrapped up in plastic and tied almost like a package. In that blanket, dog hairs were found. Police also found dog hairs in the back of Charlie's truck that they had confiscated. And his truck also had some additional things in it that led them to believe this. Every time he put gas in the truck, he kept mileage logs. He was, like, very anal about stuff, very type A. Things are done a certain way. He kept records, I mean, down to what mileage when he would fill up his gas tank.
Yeah.
So in those mileage books, they noticed that a spike occurred right around the time that Toler died, and it was 100 miles away from where Brandt lived. So he had that 100-mile spike 100 miles away from where he lived. So it all matched up with where she was found compared to where his books said he was, in the same area. Did I say that right?
Yeah, no, I get it. Everything there's another case matched up were where his locations were and where people were dying.
Oh, fully. Yeah. And dude probably never thought that this would be used as evidence for what he had done, but maybe he's keeping record of the people he had killed too.
True.
So there's another case too. This murder happened during July of 1989, and it happened just 4 blocks from his house, right by him. Under a bridge off of Big Pine Key, a local fisherman had a surprise. Initially thinking that they were reeling up like a mannequin that somebody had just dumped in, because people do dumb things in water, the fishermen were actually bringing up the body of a woman. So the detective, Trish Daly, was the lead investigator in the murder of 38-year-old Sherry Parisho, a local woman who had lived on a rowboat. So she was homeless, unfortunately. She had her bicycle that she would put on the boat, on the bow of the boat, and then she would take the boat out approximately 100 yards offshore, and that's where she lived. So she rode around on her bike, and she had her little rowboat, and she, you know, she was happy in her little life. Investigators unfortunately believe this is also where she died. Detective Daly says that what we believe happened is that she was placed on the bottom of the boat, possibly with her feet off the stern, and then decapitated. So for years, the boat has been locked away in the evidence yard. In the wood, you can see the cutting marks, leading the detectives to believe that the bottom of the boat was unfortunately where she was decapitated and cut apart.
Oh, how sad.
I know. As with the other victims, she was decapitated, heart was cut out. For years, all police had to go on was a sketch of a man spotted running across the highway. So, like, pretty much nothing.
Yeah.
That is until Jim, his former brother-in-law, had, you know, a light bulb go off and say, wait, I had a conversation with Terry about an instance where Charlie came home covered in blood.
Was in the kitchen saying he was just got done fishing.
So the timelines matched up. That day, it was the same day. So they had had that conversation. Terry had confided in Jim, and then Jim, being probably a bullheaded male, went and confronted Charlie about it and said, I look at him and I said, you know, your wife thinks that you might have committed this heinous act. And he was like, I didn't do it. So I'm like, excuse me, if after I had this conversation with your wife, I'm not going to go to you, who she thinks killed the woman, and be like, hey,
yeah,
your wife thinks you're the murderer.
Yeah, that, no.
Right?
Like, if you know that he has a past, that's not probably something.
Uh-uh.
Nope. That's bizarre.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that either.
Uh-uh. Nope, I'd probably call the cops and be like, I may or may not have a tip for you.
Exactly.
It might be worth looking into.
Yeah, and I don't know. So I've seen conflicting things and the story's not changed, but the timeline is kind of fuzzy a bit about when this conversation took place. Because to me, this would have caused issues, I feel like, between Charlie and Terry, possibly enough where he would want to murder her.
Exactly.
Which makes me wonder if Terry had this conversation closer to when she died, instead of like when it happened. Right?
Exactly. Because that was my thought too, is like, what a motive, you know?
Yes. And I couldn't, there's conflicting things. This happened in 2004. From what Jim said while he was on Dr. Phil, he said, you know, we had that conversation. It was about the same time that that girl disappeared. And I can actually play that to clear it up.
That confirmed my personal feelings that I had discussed with him. Also, I had conversations with Terry that confirmed my personal feelings that he had indeed informed her. And when I introduced Terry and Charlie, how on earth would I know that they'd ever get married? It was just a gathering, an innocent gathering of friends.
You were the best man at his wedding.
Yes.
And at some point, there was another opportunity.
That voice is Mary Lou, who is Terry's sister.
In a bar in Miami. And Terry told you about this experience with the blood. That's and you right. could have had an opportunity
she, to That's how I knew she knew. Because she referred to it in our conversation.
She referred to what?
The mother incident. She's saying, I want to call the sheriff because I know what happened with him and his mother.
Well, what
that's
happened?
What I'm trying to tell you.
From what you said initially was that you understood that when Terry saw Charlie, he turned, you know, where have you been? Because dinner's ready, you know, and he turns around, he's got blood all over him. And he says, what does it look like I've been doing? I've been cleaning fish. But he had no fish. There was no fish in the sink or on the sink.
Let me fill in some blanks for people here to be sure we haven't glossed over something. There was a point in time when you and Charlie were talking about revenge or getting even with someone.
Much
right?
earlier.
Right. Much earlier. And he said what to you?
He said the best way to get revenge is to kill somebody, cut out their heart, and eat it.
Ew.
Okay. Now, this was during the period of normalcy.
It was the right. first weird thing I had ever heard of. Gotcha.
And then the second years. Thing we're talking about is she walked in on him one day covered in blood. right, in the laundry room, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. And this was simultaneous with...
There was a murder that occurred in that area the same day that he showed up with his blood all over him. So was he involved in it? My God, I don't know. You know,
she
so
said that to who?
This guy, Jim.
She said that to you.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, I want to get all the cards on the table here, because the truth is, this gets worse.
Sorry, but if my friend told me the best way to get revenge is to kill somebody and eat their heart, that'd be a little alarming. I don't think I could continue being friends
especially
with
especially if like he that. Knew he killed his mom.
Exactly. I'd be like, I'm sorry, but this is probably not a normal conversation for you to have. Like, maybe if it was, you know, somebody else, like in a joking manner, but I'm having a really hard time taking this at, you know, anything other than you actually doing that.
Well, exactly. Okay. So do you see why I'm confused about the timelines?
Yeah.
Because he said here that she wanted to like go to the sheriff. So I feel like this happened sometime, but how could it have happened sometime closer to her death, that conversation, and not have happened like in 89 when the death happened? But how did they not get divorced if she wanted to go to the sheriff about this?
Maybe she was just scared. And then 15 years later, it all kind of bubbled up into this. I mean, from the outside, you can make your marriage look seemingly perfect, right? So I'm wondering if there was issues. She maybe was afraid to get out, didn't say anything to anybody. And eventually, obviously, they probably had their issues because they started drinking and there was a full-blown like argument. So it very well could have been this bubbling up of
like resentment.
Yeah. Like it was.
I just feel like the timing is weird.
Yeah.
But I feel like it should have caused in my head more issues between the two of them in 89. No?
No, I completely like.
Yeah. So it's weird. It's weird. Either way you look at it. And so I couldn't find an exact date, or the dates were kind of conflicting on when that conversation happened, but Jim testified, you know, in court about the conversation, and that was enough to close the case. And he was convicted of her murder as much as they can, because he's dead. So from what I've read, he's being looked at for the main suspect in 26 unsolved murders at this point.
26.
So there's two more that I found information on. One was Carol Sullivan in 1978. She was 12. Sullivan, she was abducted from a school bus stop in Volusia County in September 20th, 1978. Her skull was found in a bucket, leading authorities to presume she was murdered and decapitated. He was 20 years old and lived in that county at the time, but he could not be tied to the crime in any other way besides the fact that he lived there and they believe that she was decapitated.
Yeah.
The other is for Lisa Saunders. This was in 1988. She was 20. She was beaten, stabbed, and dragged from her car in Big Pine Key. In December of 1988, her heart was missing when she was found, but it is unclear if it was extracted by an attacker or eaten by vultures. But it was missing. And he lived in that area.
With him. You would kind of know if it was vultures, wouldn't you? I mean, they don't just like, I mean, they peck it out of you, right?
Yeah, but the skin would still be missing, like... And her body, I think, had been scavenged on a bit.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's what I have on Charlie Brandt's case. Unfortunately, he is not here to speak for his crimes and to...
What's so upsetting is that he... Oh. I feel like that was like his grand finale, is that he just took his the love of his life, if we can even call it that. He may have just been like a full-fledged psychopath and sociopath and faked everything, but like that was his grand finale. Let's take her out, and then I'm going to commit this heinous crime against her niece that I have a weird obsession with, and then I'm going to kill myself. And that's just right. Awful.
It's horribly sad.
I am really surprised that I have never heard about this, considering it's so recent. I mean, it's not recent, but it's not recent.
It's not that old. It's 15 years.
I mean, you hear about the like famous serial killers that were like in the 70s, 80s. So why are you not talking about ones that are more recent?
Well, and I'm curious how that wasn't linked before.
Yeah.
Like how people, like it hasn't been, like the cases weren't linked since 26 within the 30 year span. I feel like that's enough of a pattern, because his pattern was consistent between the ones we're looking at.
Right. Decapitate, take their heart, you know?
Yep. So I'm just surprised that there has, that they didn't link those, because I mean we've seen them do it.
I don't know, maybe we'll find out more with like technology and stuff, and if he's more involved with all of these. But you don't go from killing your mom and trying to kill your dad and sister to just being a completely different person. Because to me he snapped.
At such
a young age.
Do you want to know something really sad? So they had two younger sisters, Angela and Charlie. And those girls did not learn how their mother died until Charlie died and everything started to come out. They thought she died in a car wreck. That's what they thought for their entire lives. They never told them that Charlie had murdered their mother and shot their dad.
Where were they at?
They were young, very young.
Okay.
So they were sleeping in bed. Everyone was in bed.
So he would have essentially, if there was more bullets, gone for them too.
Probably.
That's so crazy.
So I don't know if it's like a psychotic snap and he does this or what, because she described that glazed over thing and it seemed like there has to have been some kind of snap, right?
Yeah, I mean, there had to have been. If everybody was like, oh, Charlie was such a normal boy, we would never expect this from him. Normally, when people are that young and capable of committing such gruesome, disgusting crimes, you kind of see the warning signs before that.
Exactly.
So that's just crazy.
So that's my very long case.
It was incredible. Thank you. I have never heard that before.
Isn't it messed up?
Yeah. I can see why your dad was like looking more into it, because that is like, I want to look more into it too. I feel like you could easily go down a rabbit hole, because and this is why I don't understand, sorry to go off on this tangent again, is why we don't talk more about recent serial killers. I mean, he obviously committed crimes through the 70s, 80s, you know, but there's so much more, his family and friends were on the Dr. Phil show. So we have stuff we can watch related to that, where these people are still around to speak out about it. I don't know, it's just cool.
Oh, I fully agree. And I feel like there has to be more active serial killers right now too, right?
I looked it up one time, how many are in the US about they assume that I think there are 6 operating in the US at all times.
So why aren't we getting more info about these serial killers? Like, why isn't that more of a national thing? Like, hey, we have these serial killers in your area. Maybe people know in the area, though.
Oh, I lied. This is according to thesun.com on October 16th, 2021. There may be up to 4,000 unidentified serial killers in the United States. Experts say with as many as 50 active at any one given time.
Lock your doors, like people.
One in each state.
Lock your doors.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Is there one in Idaho right now?
Probably.
I haven't heard of any. I haven't heard any. California has to have a couple. Florida has to have a couple.
Well, you also have to kind of think about it. Like, we used to see all those missing kids posters and Walmarts and stuff. Those could be the work of serial killers, and they just haven't been found. And the bodies haven't been found.
My, if you want to call it an ex-boyfriend from high school is missing.
What?
And he's been missing since we were like in high school. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I haven't talked about this. His name's Zach Brewer and he's missing. He went missing, I think, in 2009, 2010. So we were like freshmen. Disappeared. And there was like weird stuff going on where I think he was like testifying against somebody. Weird stuff, but he's been missing for, I mean, years. His mom doesn't know where he is.
Oh my gosh.
It's very sad.
That's super sad. I remember you telling me that though, because I was like, wait, I know a Zach Brewer. Has he been missing this entire time? But it was different Zach Brewer.
Oh. Okay, let's hear your case.
Okay. I'm going to be covering the case of Paige Bergfield. And Paige was your everyday soccer mom. She adored her kids and being a mom. And I mean, that's exactly what she wanted to be when she was growing up. Her father remembers her telling her that all she wanted out of life was to be a mom. And her children were the center of her universe. And everybody said that Paige was just an amazing and caring mother who put her children first. So when Paige didn't come home one night, her family and her friends obviously knew straight away that something awful had to have happened to her, because there was no way that she would have gone anywhere on her own willingly without her children. So to backtrack a little bit, Paige went to college in Florida on a scholarship for nursing. And while she was in Gainesville, Florida, attending college, she met her first husband, and his name is Ron Beigler. The two of them quickly fell in love. They ended up moving back to Colorado together because I think this is where they were originally from. Soon after moving to Colorado, they got married. But almost as quickly as their relationship started, it also fell apart. And Ron wasn't interested in having kids, which I think is kind of odd that this wasn't like brought up possibly previously in the relationship. I don't know if he promised her that he would give it a thought, but Paige wasn't willing to give up her entire dream of having children. And the couple ended up splitting only a couple years after tying the knot. It wasn't an ugly separation or anything, and it seemed to have been a mutual split. And the two remained friendly, like they weren't in contact all the time, but they still remained, you know, acquaintances, had no hard feelings towards each other. Right. After this, Paige decided to work at a strip club. She was newly single. She could really use the money in order to stay on her feet and support herself financially. I'm not sure if she actually completed her nursing degree or not. I couldn't find this anywhere, if she had ever worked a nursing job or finished school for that. But it's no secret that strippers and people in the adult entertainment industry can make quite a bit of money. So it makes sense to me that it was what she did in order to pay her bills. Mm-hmm. Like her sister-in-law, Callie, even said that she actually admitted to her once that she was making upwards of $400,000 a year at the strip club in Colorado.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So,
okay, well, I get it.
Right? Fuck nursing. While she was working at this club, she met her second husband, and his name is Rob Dixon. So don't get these guys confused. First husband, Ron. Second husband, Rob with a B. Okay. Rob seemed to check all these boxes that Paige was looking for in a husband. He was kind. He wanted a family and have kids. And it was a plus because he came from a very wealthy family, which in turn meant that he also had a lot of money. His friend or his family loved giving back. He was known to even donate equipment and emergency vehicles to first responders in the community. And Paige really found this attractive, that he was like giving back. He wasn't selfish with his money. So here's this guy who wanted the same things out of life. He was completely set up financially, and they really, really liked each other. So in 1998, the pair moved to Grand Junction, Colorado, which is outside of Denver. Their house was absolutely beautiful and crazy expensive. Now, Grand Junction wasn't, and I don't think it is still, like a super fancy or expensive place to live. And their mortgage, do you want to take just a guess on how much their mortgage was a month?
What year is this?
This is 1998.
Okay. Oh shoot, I'm gonna be 800.
$6,000. In 1998, what? Can you imagine how immaculate this house had to have been?
Okay, I thought 800 was expensive.
Yes, $6,000.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's and a huge house. That's a huge house.
And I mean, Grand Junction was not like a super expensive place to live. So like,
no.
No. And by 2001, they had already been married and had three children together. So their lives moved pretty quick, and life seemed pretty seemingly perfect to everyone around them. They had a beautiful family, a super nice house. They owned a bunch of exotic and fancy cars like Lamborghinis and stuff. Unfortunately, Rob made some pretty bad business decisions, which affected the family's finances tremendously. He had invested and lost millions of dollars, which put a huge strain on their marriage, which is to be expected. Like, debt and finances is one of the leading causes of divorce. Right. So in 2004, Paige actually made a call to 911 claiming that Rob was supposed to watch their children while she went to work. I'm not exactly, I think she, at this time she was, she owned a dance studio. So,
okay.
Not like an adult one, but like with children. just thought I'd clarify. So he was supposed to be watching the kids, and the two of them got into an argument about it. She tells 911 that Rob told her she would come home to find the children murdered, which would be an absolutely terrifying thing to hear. And I would call the police too, if my husband said that. But
right.
Police arrive, and the two of them told police that they had worked everything out. Everything was fine. And they just didn't need assistance anymore, which I don't want to speak ill of Paige, because spoiler alert, she's no longer with us. But if this actually happened, which Rob denies up and down, he never said this, he was going to murder his children. Wouldn't you keep your children away from them? Him?
Yes.
Right? I mean, she was a mama bear.
She may have been getting abused, though.
Yeah, which we'll get into it a little bit later on some of the stuff that she had said. So, I mean, I know people say things out of anger, but like saying you're going to murder your kids, that's not normal. So,
no, that's not.
Yeah. And like I said, Rob said this never actually happened. And the reason that Paige said this was to set him up to look like the bad guy. He believed.
Okay, I'm sorry. Time, why would you stay with her though?
Right. And he believed that their relationship was probably coming to an end at that point anyway. And in order for her to receive full custody of the kids, she had to make him look like the bad guy in order to do that. So he thinks that she was building up this case against him in order to keep her kids, which we'll get into it in a second, but it doesn't even sound like he wanted them. So.
Oh, Lord.
So in 2005, police get another phone call from Paige. And this time she claims that Rob had hit her while she was holding their youngest child. At this time, Paige was going out and secretly doing sex work again on the side in order to help their finances. And Rob was really mad about it. He found some like lingerie pieces and confronted her about it, and she felt like she had no other option but to help in some way. Like, he had lost millions of their millions of their money. And so she felt like she had to contribute in some way in order to keep a roof over their head. And before that, before they were married, Rob was seemingly pretty like supportive of her work in the industry. I mean, they met at a strip club. So
he knew.
He knew that she had done that work before. So why is it surprising that when you're hard on finances, that she would go out and do what she can in order to help?
Right.
And at this point, like, Paige believed he felt differently, like, wasn't supportive of this job. And when police arrived, Rob was arrested for domestic violence, misdemeanor child abuse, and third degree assault. He was court ordered to take anger management classes, and the charges were actually dropped eventually. He did have to complete those anger management classes, though.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Rob swears up and down he never hit Paige, he never threatened his kids, and he full-heartedly believed that she was setting him up. Their finances were getting tighter and tighter. There was no way they were going to be able to afford the lifestyle that they had previously had. Rob was backed enough into a corner that they ended up having to file for bankruptcy, which really devastated him and his image in the community. I mean, he was donating equipment to first responders, and these things were getting repossessed because he didn't pay for them in full. He was financing them.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So there's that small community getting, you know, really important resources stripped away from them, which did not look good for Rob.
Right.
In 2006, Paige and Rob filed for divorce. And coming back to what I said earlier, Rob ended up moving to Pennsylvania and wasn't really involved in his kids' lives. So Paige was obviously granted full custody of the children, which meant Paige had an enormous mortgage that she was going to have to figure out how to afford for herself and her kids, because she wasn't going to, I mean, as a mom, I can understand wanting some consistency in your kids' lives when your parents are divorced and you have to move into a whole new house and start over this completely new life. It can be really devastating. So she really wanted to step up and be able to have that home that they've been used to as their home still. In order to do this, though, she got suckered into joining an MLM, which, if anyone doesn't know what that is, it stands for a multi-level marketing, and it's a pyramid scheme.
Oh, yes, it is.
These, quote, businesses really target moms who want to have the freedom of staying home with their kids while making an income. And I've been conned into two of these. Have you ever been conned into any, Gina?
They're like being a part of them?
Yeah, like being a...
I mean, like people have asked consultant. And I've said no.
I joined Cutco once and I joined Mary Kay.
Oh, wait, when did you do Mary Kay?
Oh, like when Tom and I first got married. It lasted maybe that. 3 weeks.
So they're a complete scheme.
Oh, yeah. It's ridiculous. Paige, though, was very successful. She ended up joining Pampered Chef. And I'm not going to lie, they do have some really great products, but she really excelled with Pampered Chef, so much so that she was one of their top sellers, and she even got a free trip to the Caribbean out of it. So she was, she was living it. On top of Pampered Chef, she also had her dance studio for children called Brain Dance. She did several dance classes. She made all the costumes for the kids and held really big recitals. It was kind of this perfect thing for her too, because she loved being around kids, and it also offered her the flexibility of working around her schedule so that she could also be present in her own children's lives. And she also sold baby slings on the side for like nursing moms. Needless to say, Paige worked her butt off to do anything she could to afford for her kids to have the life that she believed they deserved. And like I said, have that same consistency of having their home and living a life that was similar to what they had been before they got a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
On Friday, June 22nd, Paige was actually at a friend's house and mentioned something that caught her friend really off guard. She told her that she was concerned for her safety. And this friend assumed Paige was referring to her ex-husband, Rob. She assured Paige that there was nothing to worry about, that he was on the East Coast, so he was way too far away to do anything. Paige had actually been writing on a Pampered Chef forum, which was basically just a place for Pampered Chef consultants to talk business and whatnot. And on this forum, Paige was sharing some pretty concerning details about her being afraid of her ex-husband. One of her posts even said, quote, "My children would ask me if dad was going to kill me. I can't imagine what they were thinking life would be like after he killed me," which is so sad to have your kids be asking you about. That's horribly sad. Yeah.
Yep.
On Thursday, June 28th, Paige actually met up with her first husband, Ron, with an N. So Ron and Paige actually had just started talking again for a couple of months, and she really felt like she was still in love with him even after all these years that had passed. So she was really excited to see him again. I don't know if I would go back to somebody that didn't want kids because I would be afraid that they wouldn't accept my kids, but Ron seemed to be like a really, really great guy. So I think that they were kind of testing the waters to see if this kind of relationship would work for them. And on June 28th, they met up halfway between Denver and Grand Junction, because I think he was still living in the Denver area when they had moved after Florida. So they met up in Eagle, Colorado, and had a nice little picnic by the river, which is so cute. It was at a truck stop, but they like went down to the river, had a picnic, had a good time. After their little date, they both left separately back to their houses. And Ron made it back to Denver before Paige made it back to Grand Junction. He had actually called her around 9 p.m. when he got home to see where she was at. And she wasn't quite to Grand Junction yet, but was pretty close to home. So she told him that once she got home, she'd give him a call, but that call never came. That evening, her kids started calling her and leaving voicemails, asking where she was because she wasn't home yet. And I mean, these voicemails are like heartbreaking. Her older daughter, Jess, left one just like sobbing, saying, "I'm so mad at you. Like, why aren't you home yet? You said you would be home by now." And you could really tell that these kids relied so much on their mom, and she didn't disappoint them. So this was like devastating for them.
That's so sad.
Yeah. Thankfully, they were at home with a live-in nanny, but all of them were becoming super concerned because this wasn't like Paige. The next morning when the kids woke up, Paige still wasn't home. And that's when Ron started calling her phone frantically too. She didn't call him last night. And so he was trying to get a hold of her, but her phone went straight to voicemail, which was also really weird to him because she always had her phone on and charged in case her kids had to get a hold of her. So this was very alarming to him. They had their date on Thursday. So I'm just going to kind of give the week perspective, because on Saturday, Ron finally called the family home. And that's when Paige's 8-year-old daughter, Jess, told him that she hadn't been home since Thursday before she left for their date. At that point, Ron made the decision to call and report Paige as a missing person.
Smart.
Right. Unfortunately for Ron, though, even though he was the first one to call and report her, he became their first suspect. They were able to rule him out eventually with an alibi and him cooperating fully with police. He was devastated, and even her parents were like, "This is not something Ron would do. Like, you're looking at the wrong guy." This is when police finally learned that Paige was involved again in sex work. And most people in her life had no idea that she was doing this. And if they knew that she had done it previously, they really didn't have any idea, I think, except for a couple of people in her life, that she was doing it again. And so people were absolutely shocked to find this out. Her parents were shocked. beyond belief. They had no idea.
Of course.
That she was involved in this kind of work. She must have told Ron because he told authorities that Paige was supposed to meet up with a couple of clients that evening after he left their date. And Paige, they realized, had a completely alternate life online as an escort known as Carrie. And she was very, very successful in this industry. She advertised that she was willing to go to a client's home or meet up at a rented office space that she had had. Side note, she actually told the landlord of this office space that she was doing acupuncture, but inside the office space was literally a table with needles and like one of those tomato pin cushions, which is obviously like not how you store acupuncture needles. I mean, just imagine referring a friend to someone you believe is an acupuncturist, and in reality, they're like an escort. Wouldn't that be a really awkward conversation later?
Yes.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So police start their investigation by looking into her cell phone records, which is very smart. They were able to reach out to some of her most recent clients and interview them. They also looked into Rob, her first husband, considering the stuff that she had told her friends. I mean, he was looked at pretty thoroughly, considering everything. I mean, the Pampered Chef forums, their previous toxic history with the phone calls to police. But Rob was confirmed to be in Philadelphia at the time of her disappearance. And Rob was actually like really shocked to hear about his ex-wife. Nobody told him. In fact, he flew out to Colorado immediately after hearing the news to be with his kids, which, good on him.
Yep.
So now that both of the ex-husbands were cleared from any wrongdoing, police entertained the idea that maybe she just left, because we've said it before, like, adults are able to get up and leave. Maybe life had gotten to be too much for her and she just wanted to start over somewhere else. But her fans and family swore up and down and put this theory to rest almost as soon as it was brought up, because she was extremely devoted and reliable for her kids. Her dad even mentioned something along the lines of, if somebody came and broke both of her legs and her kids were in danger, like, she would crawl on her elbows to get to her kids before anything happened to them. If she wanted to escape and start over somewhere else, there's no way she would have left her kids behind. Plus, there was no evidence that she planned to leave anyway. None of her clothes or belongings were missing from the home. So the police kind of gave up on this theory as quickly as it was brought up. On July 1st, around 9 p.m., a call was made to police about a car on fire in a parking lot. And this car ended up belonging to none other than Paige. Immediately, police suspect that foul play is involved. And despite it being very badly burnt, they were able to comb through the car and find some important clues to the case. They found Paige's day planner, which was something she took absolutely everywhere. She was a meticulous planner and wrote every single thing down. And the last four pages of the planner had actually been ripped out and were missing. Another huge clue was that the driver's seat was pushed almost all the way back, which is not something that Paige at 5'4" would be able to do and safely drive the car, which obviously means somebody else drove the car there and set it on fire. And the car was set on fire, like, the accelerant that was used started on the passenger seat. On July 14th, 2 weeks later, authorities and about 150 volunteers went out looking for Paige around Grand Junction. And although they didn't find Paige, they did find some of her belongings on the other side of town along the highway, about 15 miles away from where they discovered her car. So it wouldn't make sense that she was on that side of town, because it was the opposite side of town of where she would have been coming from Eagle, Colorado, when she met up with Ron. So it was weird that these items were on the opposite side of town. And these items.
So somebody was like obviously scattering her stuff.
Yeah. So either these things were like thrown out of her purse by somebody else, or what some of, and a couple of these items were like a Blockbuster's card, her checkbook, credit cards, stuff that would have been in her purse.
Was she trying to like leave a trail?
And ding, ding, ding. That's what a lot of people think too. I was going to bring that up later, but yeah, people either believe that whoever had her was like throwing stuff out of the car to get rid of evidence that that she was in their vehicle, or she could have been throwing things out to leave like a breadcrumbs. So
scary.
Yeah. A few weeks passed by, and at this point the case was at a standstill. So the police try another tactic and bring in some canines to the car to see if they could hit on anything that might give them another direction to head. And the dogs actually hit on an RV store that was right across the street from the parking lot where the car was. At this RV store worked a mechanic named Lester Jones.
Great name.
Have you ever met a Lester that wasn't creepy, honestly?
No.
According to some friends and rumors that were circulating around town, Lester had been wanting to be one of Paige's clients for quite some time, but she downright refused because she had a really icky feeling about him and she wanted absolutely nothing to do with it.
No, duh, his name's Lester.
Right.
Sorry, if your name's Lester, your parents didn't love you.
Yeah. And please don't ever name your child Lester if you're considering it, because it's not going to go well.
I'm sorry if you like that name. Please send us an email or a DM and let us know why.
We'll help you pick a different name.
Unless you have like a terrific reason.
Which I would need some backup evidence as to why you think that, because I'm not buying it. I need a full-on PowerPoint for that. Police look into Lester's criminal history, and wouldn't you know it, he had some charges against him because of an incident with his ex-wife. And this story is crazy to me.
Shocker.
He chased his ex-wife. They were in two separate cars. He chased her so quickly up a mountain that her airbags went off. Yeah. Like, they weren't in an accident. Her airbags went off because of how fast she was driving up this mountain. Isn't that scary?
Like on a straight road, or was it curvy road?
I don't know if it was just like, maybe they were on a very rough dirt road. But then had a male passenger with her that was her friend, and they got out of the vehicle, and Lester shot at this friend, and the friend didn't get hit, but the bullet like grazed his hat. So anyway, he spent multiple years in prison for this. The police were able to get a warrant to search Lester's home and his work based on the dogs hitting on the RV store and his previous criminal history. And in doing so, they found some things of interest, but nothing incriminating, like just stuff referencing sex workers and just kind of, you know, out of the ordinary things, but nothing to link him to a crime. Plus, at this point, Paige's body hadn't been found yet, so there wasn't anything that could be done anyway. Typically, no body, no crime, unfortunately, so they were looking into her phone records again and found out that one of the last people she had spoken with had a burner phone. And guess who had a burner phone? Lester Jones.
Lester.
Yeah. He was caught on surveillance tape purchasing a burner phone at Walmart, which he denies up and down. And the police were like, look, dude, we literally have you on camera. There were only 5 calls made from this phone, and every single one of them was to Paige's phone. Again, not a crime.
Of course.
Very suspicious, though. It wasn't until 2012 when a hiker came across the body of Paige Bergfeld. Her remains were confirmed via her dental records. Unfortunately, it was pretty obvious that she was more than likely beaten to death. Her jawbone was severely fractured, and there was duct tape on her skull, which shows more than likely she had been tied up and her mouth, you know, forced shut with duct tape. Her remains were found outside of Grand Junction in the direction of where her belongings were found alongside of the road. So like we had brought up earlier, it could have been that whoever murdered her was throwing things out of the car to erase evidence, which isn't exactly a really smart thing to do anyway, or she was throwing things out of the car in an attempt to leave a trail, essentially.
Well, with her body being found that direction, it feels like that's what she was doing.
I agree. Lester Jones was still a person of interest in this case because he really was their only suspect. So they searched his vehicles again. And this is in 2012, so many years after they had originally gone through his stuff. At this point, he had gotten remarried, so they searched both his car and his wife's car. I don't know what they were expecting to find years after the fact, but they searched anyway and came up empty-handed yet again, which had to have been extremely frustrating. When the officer called Lester to come pick up the cars, something very strange happened. So basically he says, you can come and pick up your cars. And he said, you asked me where I buried the body. And he was like, I'm sorry, what? And he says, you asked me where I buried the body. And the police officer was like, when did I ask you that? And then Lester gets really quiet on the other end. And the police officer is like, are you there? And then it ends. The call. Well, what? Not the call, but the recording. Yeah.
But freaky.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if he was just so guilt-ridden that he finally was just handing himself over in a way. I don't know if he was under the influence or what, but thank goodness they had that phone call recorded.
Right.
In November of 2014, the police finally had enough to arrest Lester. Paige's family was so relieved that finally they had somebody who could possibly be held responsible for the loss of her after 9 years of her disappearance.
Oh.
So Lester did end up going to trial for the murder. After the first trial, he ends up going to two. The jury wasn't able to make a unanimous decision. There just wasn't enough physical evidence for that specific trial or those specific jurors. So in December of 2016, he went to his second and final trial where the jury did find him guilty of first degree murder of Paige. He was sentenced to life in prison. Yes.
Good.
Before I finish, I just wanted to mention that after Rob returned back home to Pennsylvania, Paige's brother and sister-in-law, Paige's brother is actually a plastic surgeon in Seattle. So they actually moved into her home in Grand Junction and took on raising the three kids as their own, which is just amazing. Yeah. And they seem like such an
incredible couple. Did they have kids themselves?
I did not read anything on that. And
okay.
I also have read some kind of conflicting stories on whether or not the kids moved back, because they ended up moving back to Seattle eventually. I don't know if the kids moved back with them to Seattle or if they went and lived with their father in Pennsylvania. I've heard both things during the second trial.
Okay. Maybe they're back Paige's, and forth.
Yeah. Because I mean, in the second trial, Paige's dad has an interview and he said that the reason why he didn't go to the trial is because he was up in Seattle with his grandkids and being supportive and there for them while the trial was happening. So I don't know.
Okay.
The kids are now, I think, between the ages of 17 and 22, maybe
out of the house,
a little bit older now, but yeah, now they're, you know, a little bit older, staying definitely out of the media. So either way, I hope they're successful and doing okay despite losing their mother.
Right. But
that is my case on Paige Bergfield, the soccer mom / escort. So
sad.
I know. It's very sad.
And Lester's, I'm sorry. Get a new name.
Yeah, please. Or just don't go by Lester. Less is good. Less is fine.
Less is good. Not Lester. Yes. No.
Yeah. We gotta take that part out.
No. Sometimes curves. Less is more.
Wow, that was great.
Thank you.
I would have never in a million years come up with that.
Thanks. Late night thoughts with Gina. I hope everyone enjoyed this case. I know I did.
Yes, those were both great cases.
I mean, enjoyed as much as
much as you can here. Enjoy murder. But
we're all involved in this.
Yep. So yeah, thank you guys so much for listening. You can find us on TikTok and Instagram at Dark and Dudley Pod, or you can Gmail us, especially you Lester lovers, at darkanddudleypod@gmail.com. Don't forget to follow our podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you happen to be on Apple, don't feel shy and rate us 5 stars and leave us a comment to get our podcast circulating. It's totally free. As always, we hope you have an amazing week, and we will see you here next week for Gina's case.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye.